Okay, let's unpack this. I want to start with a fight. Not a physical one, obviously, but a civil war that has been quietly raging inside university departments for decades. It's this central tension that I think is so fundamental. And it's this question: can you actually do philosophy without doing history? Can you just sit in a room and have these big, timeless thoughts? Or are you obligated to know how those ideas got into your head in the first place?
It really is the fundamental divide, isn't it? It's the fault line that runs right through the whole discipline. On one side, you have the, let's call them the analytic purists. They believe philosophy is timeless. An argument is an argument. It doesn't matter if it was made in Athens or New York.
Logic doesn't age.
But on the other side, you've got the historian's worry, which is if you ignore the context, you're not actually engaging with the ideas at all. You're just, talking to yourself, projecting your own biases onto the past.
And the risk is real on both sides. If you ignore history, you're just arrogant. You think you just invented morality this morning. But if you go too far the other way, you're just cataloging dusty opinions. Here's what a guy in a toga thought. Who cares?
Notes from underground.
So today we are diving into a book that basically grabs this tension by the throat and just refuses to let go. We are looking at Bernard Williams on Philosophy and History. It's a massive new volume from Oxford University Press. And honestly, it feels like a toolkit for this exact fight.
It really is a heavyweight contribution, and we should definitely introduce the architects behind it right away because they've done a really tremendous job here. It's edited by Marcel Van Akeren and Mathieu Queloz. And just a quick note for everyone listening on that second name, it's spelled Queloz, but the Z is silent. It rhymes with hello.
Queloz.
Queloz.
Got it. Queloz like hello. So what's the mission here? Because looking through it, this doesn't feel like a standard biography at all. We're not walking through his childhood or anything.
No. Absolutely not. The mission of this deep dive is strictly methodological. This is a toolkit.
A toolkit. I like that.
We are presenting this volume to philosophy students, to scholars, basically anyone wrestling with this question of how do I combine rigorous, systematic philosophy with the messy reality of history? It's not who was Bernard Williams so much as how did he think and how can I think like that?
It's about getting your hands dirty.
Precisely. It's about impure
Well, I
philosophy.
love that phrase, impure philosophy. It sounds a little scandalous.
Well, to a certain kind of philosopher, it is scandalous. But let's get into the trajectory of his career because A.W. Moore, who wrote the foreword, lays this out so beautifully. You can't understand why Williams cared so much about history without seeing where he started from.
He didn't just jump into this.
Not at all.
Okay, so Moore breaks it down into three phases. Phase one was all metaphysics and identity, the really abstract stuff, making sense of basic thought.
Correct. This was the early Williams, 1950s, 60s. He was deep in the engine room of analytic philosophy, asking questions like, what is personal identity? What is the self?
Questions you tackle with logic, with thought experiments.
You don't necessarily need a history book for that, or so it seemed at the time.
But then he shifts. Phase two, ethics, making sense of how to live. And that seems to be the pivot point for everything.
That is the crucial moment because once you stop asking, what is an object? And you start asking, how should I live? You realize you can't answer that in a vacuum. You're living now in this culture with these specific values. You can't derive how to live from pure logic alone. You have to look at the world.
Which leads him inevitably to phase three.
Self-consciousness. Self-consciousness about philosophy itself, its scope, its limits. Williams started asking, what is this thing we're even doing? Why do we think the way we do? And that is where history comes rushing in. You can't answer, why do we think this way, without asking, where did these thoughts come from?
Okay, and this is where he makes that big distinction, right? The one between the history of science and the history of philosophy.
Yes, and this is so important to his whole project. He calls the history of science vindicatory.
Vindicatory, meaning it proves we were right to move on.
Essentially, yes. It's a history of discovery and progress. Think about it. A modern physicist doesn't need to read Newton's Principia to do physics. They definitely don't need to read Aristotle on physics.
Because we know more now. We've absorbed Newton's good ideas and discarded the rest.
His truths have been absorbed, corrected, or superseded. It's a history of progress.
It's like a ladder. You climb up the discoveries of previous scientists, and once you get to the top, you can just kick the ladder away. You don't need it anymore.
That is the perfect metaphor. The history of science is a ladder you kick away. But, and here is the absolute kicker, Philosophy does not have a vindicatory history.
We haven't solved Plato.
We haven't solved Plato. We haven't solved justice or the good life. We haven't proven him wrong in the way we prove that the earth revolves around the sun.
You can't just say, oh, Plato was the beta version and now we're running Ethics 2.0.
It would be absurd. We still read Plato, not as a curiosity, but because he might actually be right about something we've forgotten. Williams argues that philosophy is a history of change, not just a history of simple progress.
So it's a different kind of beast entirely. If science kicks away the ladder and, say, a history of art isn't the same as painting, where does that leave philosophy?
It's the great outlier. As Moore explains it in the foreword, a history of science isn't science. A history of art isn't art. But the history of philosophy is philosophy.
Wow.
You can't do the work without engaging with the past. The past is the raw material. It's not just the backstory.
And he had that amazing musical analogy for this, right? Something about Stravinsky.
Yes. It's such a sophisticated image. Stravinsky's Ballet Pulcinella. It's based on music that they thought at the time was by the 18th century composer Pergolesi. Okay. So the melodic line, the tune, is from the past. It's Pergolesi. But the harmony, the orchestration, the whole texture is pure Stravinsky. It sounds modern, it feels modern, but its bones are ancient.
That is such a cool way to think about it. So doing history of philosophy is a rational reconstruction. You're taking the melody of the past, Descartes' ideas, Hume's arguments, but you're orchestrating them with modern instruments.
You're making them play for a modern audience.
For us.
And that orchestration, that's where the real method comes in. It's not just a cover band. It's a reinterpretation. Which brings us to the introduction of the book itself by Van Acheren and Queloz. They identify four specific ways Williams connects these two fields. We should walk through them. This is the real toolkit part.
Let's do it. So number one seems pretty straightforward. Educational necessity.
Straightforward, but you'd be surprised how often it's overlooked in some departments. It's the simple claim that you cannot learn philosophy without reading the actual texts.
Right. You can't just read the Wikipedia summary of Kant.
You have to grapple with Kant himself. You can't just memorize the conclusion. You have to struggle through the argument. You're learning the moves, not just the results.
It's like learning a sport. You don't learn to play tennis by reading the final score.
Exactly. Okay, so number two takes it a step further. Philosophical comprehension. This is the idea that you can't even be a good historian without being a philosopher.
Wait, unpack that a bit. Why does a historian need to be a philosopher?
Because, Williams argues, just repeating a past thinker's words is self-defeating. If you just quote Aristotle, you're not explaining him. To understand what he was doing, you have to reconstruct his problems.
The puzzle he was trying to solve.
The puzzle. And to do that, you have to use modern philosophical concepts to translate his worries into something we can actually grasp. You have to interpret, not just transcribe. You have to act as a translator across time.
Otherwise, you're just a parrot.
A very well-read parrot, but a parrot nonetheless.
Okay. Which leads us to the big one. Connection number three. The distinction he makes between the history of ideas and the history of philosophy. This feels like the absolute core of the book.
It is. People mix these up constantly, and Williams is very, very specific here.
So history of ideas is what?
History of ideas is basically history before philosophy. The primary goal there is authenticity.
Yeah.
You're asking, what did this mean to them then?
Okay.
You're looking at the whole context of the time, the politics, the religion. You want to know what Locke's words meant to a 17th century English reader?
That sounds like standard history. So how is history of philosophy different?
That is philosophy before history. The goal is articulating philosophical ideas. And Williams says there's a cutoff point. There's a moment when you have to stop worrying about pure historical authenticity and you start asking,
is this argument any good?
Exactly. Is it strong? What does it mean for us right now?
But there's a huge danger there, isn't there? A massive trade-off. If you make it too relevant to today, you're not reading Descartes anymore. You're just using him as a sock puppet for your own ideas.
Precisely. That is the danger, and Williams is totally aware of that tension. If you make it too modern, you lose the history. You lose the otherness of the past thinker. But if you make it too historical, it might just be boring and philosophically irrelevant. You're walking a tightrope.
And the fourth connection is the historicist turn. This is the later Williams we're talking about now, right? Mm. The genealogy stuff.
Yes. This is where he moves beyond just studying past philosophers and starts realizing that our own concepts, liberty, truth, morality, they all have a history. He's channeling Nietzsche here.
Right.
Nietzsche had that famous line that only that which has no history can be defined.
That's a heavy quote. What does that actually mean?
Well, think about a triangle. A triangle has no history. Its definition is the same now as it was in ancient Egypt. You can define it perfectly, but now try to define justice or truth or authenticity.
They've changed completely.
Radically. They've accumulated layers of meaning, baggage, contradictions. You can't just give a dictionary definition of liberty. To understand it, you need a genealogy. You need to tell the story of how it grew, warts and all.
So our whole mental landscape is a historical ruin, not some clean, logical grid.
That is the historicist turn, in a nutshell.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned about walking that tightrope. The book talks about something called the alienation effect. It sounds negative, but Williams seems to think it's a good thing.
It's essential. The alienation effect is the antidote to what he saw as the common room view of philosophy.
He's a man, man.
It's a very Oxbridge kind of idea. The tendency to treat Plato or Hume as if they were just colleagues down the hall.
Oh, right.
As if they just published a paper and you're going to argue with them over coffee.
Like Plato's just a guy in a tweed jacket who happens to write in Greek. Interesting point, Plato, but have you considered this counterexample from social media?
Exactly. It domesticates them. It makes them safe. It assumes they're asking the exact same questions we are. And William says, no, that destroys the whole point. The goal isn't to find people who agree with us. The goal is to find voices that are untimely.
We want to be alienated.
We need to be. We need to see how deeply strange their thinking was.
Because that strangeness holds up a mirror to us.
Yes. When we see how differently the Greeks thought about a concept like shame or necessity, we realize that our modern moral ideas aren't these inevitable truths written in the stars. They're contingent. They are, in a sense, historical accidents.
So you make the familiar strange in order to see how strange the familiar really is.
That is the mantra. By seeing the Greeks as alien, we start to see ourselves as alien. Why are we so obsessed with guilt? Why is free will the center of our moral universe? The Greeks weren't like that. It forces us to question our own common sense.
And Williams quotes Nietzsche to hammer this home, something about ghosts.
It's a haunting image. He says if we don't give these past works our soul and our blood, they speak as a ghost to ghosts.
Wow. We have to lend them our life, our concerns, to make them speak to us, even if that means we risk a little anachronism. If you treat them as dead specimens in a museum, they stay dead.
Okay, let's look at how he actually put this into practice. The book has these great case studies, Antiquity, the Enlightenment. Let's start with Plato. Well, Williams had a reputation for being pretty tough on Plato, didn't he?
He did, especially on Plato's universalism, this idea that there's one single right way to live for everyone, everywhere. Williams was a pluralist to his core. He hated that kind of moral certainty. But Marcel Van Acheren's essay in this volume makes a fascinating case that Williams actually deeply admired Plato.
Really? How so?
Not for his conclusions, but for the invention of the discipline itself. Williams saw that Plato was the one who framed philosophy as a way to improve human life. He loved the ambition of the project, even if he disagreed with the specific moral theories Plato developed.
Okay.
And there's a great detail Van Acheren points out about luck.
Luck. Plato doesn't seem like a guy who believed in luck. He was all about the forms, about eternal reason. But that's the nuance Williams finds. He highlights that Plato understood that for philosophy to succeed in the world, it needs luck and favorable surroundings. It's fragile. It can't just fix a broken society through pure reason. If the world collapses, philosophy collapses with it. It's a very humanistic reading of Plato.
That's fascinating. Okay, let's jump forward to the Enlightenment. Descartes.
No.
John Cottingham has the essay on him. Now, Descartes is usually the bad guy in these stories, isn't he?
He's often the punching bag, yeah. Oh. The guy who split the mind from the body, who thought we could achieve absolute certainty.
A project of pure inquiry.
That's exactly how William saw him, as the ultimate pure inquirer. The man sitting by the fire, doubting everything away until he's left with just his own mind.
I think, therefore I am.
And Williams respected the sheer intellectual courage of that, the rigor. But, and here comes the alienation effect again, he uses history to show us that this perspective is actually really, really strange.
It's not the normal human way of being.
Not at all. We live our lives embedded in a world, in a body, in a history. This project of stepping out of human life entirely to find an absolute truth, that's a very specific, historically located project. It's not the default. The view from nowhere is actually a view from somewhere very particular.
And then there's Hume. I feel like Williams and Hume would have gotten along. They have that same kind of skeptical, dry British sensibility.
They certainly shared enemies. The essays by Lorenzo Greco and Paul Wessel really dig into this. Williams loved Hume because Hume resisted what he called the morality system, that strict, blame-heavy, rule-based structure of modern morality.
The idea that morality is just about following a set of divine or quasi-divine commands.
Right. They both hated that. But they had a major falling out, methodologically. Yeah.
How so?
Williams thought Hume wasn't historical enough.
Hume, the guy who wrote A Massive History of England.
I know, the irony is great, isn't it? But philosophically, Hume believed that human nature was constant. He thought that a Roman citizen from 2,000 years ago and an 18th century Scotsman were basically running the same software.
Just on a different hardware, in a different environment.
Exactly. Hume thought the passions, love, hate, pride, fear, were universal and unchanging. But Williams, the modern historicist, argues that human nature itself is shaped by history. Our software changes. Our passions are not the same as a Roman's passions. We are shaped by our culture all the way down.
So Hume is like this bridge figure. He's a precursor to Williams' way of thinking, but he doesn't go all the way.
He's on the road, but he gets off at an earlier exit.
Okay, this brings us to the whole section on genealogy. We touched on Nietzsche, but the book goes deep on this. Mm-hmm. Peter Kahle and David Owen have chapters on it. So how does Williams's genealogy actually work as a tool? It's not just telling a story, right?
No, it's a very specific hybrid method. He combines a state of nature story with real history.
The state of nature, you mean like Hobbes? Mm. Life is nasty, British, and short.
Similar idea, but he applies it to concepts. He uses it as a kind of fictional logical abstraction. He asks, imagine a basic human group. What do they need to survive? They need reliable information.
Where the food is, where the predators are.
Precisely. So that basic need for cooperation and survival creates a functional pressure for two virtues. Accuracy, getting things right, and sincerity, saying what you actually believe.
Okay, so you derive the need for truth from the bare bones of survival. If everyone lies about where the tigers are, the group dies.
That's the state of nature part. It's an abstract functionalist story. But then he layers real history on top of that. He'll talk about how Thucydides changed our standards for accuracy, or how the Romantic movement created new, more demanding ideas about sincerity.
And the goal of all this is what?
To vindicate the value of truthfulness, he wants to show that our commitment to truth isn't just some arbitrary bourgeois convention. It's functionally necessary for any complex human life to flourish.
But isn't genealogy usually used to debunk things? You know, the classic Nietzschean move. You think your morality is noble. Let me tell you about its grubby origins in priestly resentment.
Right, that's the subversive genealogy. It aims to expose the dirty roots in order to kill the plant. But Williams is trying to do a vindicatory genealogy. He wants to save truth, not destroy it. He wants to dig down to find a solid, functional foundation for it.
But he's still admitting it has a history.
Oh, absolutely. That's the Nietzschean shadow. He admits that while the need for truth might be universal, the specific shape our concept of truth takes is historical and contingent.
And that connects to the chapters on R.G. Collingwood, right? Mm-hmm. By Giuseppina Doro and James Connolly. He's the other big influence here.
He is. And the big thing that unites Williams and Collingwood is their fight against scientism.
Scientism. The idea that natural science can explain absolutely everything.
Everything. Including human history and human consciousness. And they both say, no, absolutely not. You cannot understand human history using the methods of natural science. You can't just measure physical movements from the outside.
You have to get the inside view.
You have to reconstruct the agent's thoughts, their reasons, their perspective.
It's the difference between saying Caesar's arm holding a metal object moved at a certain velocity across a line and saying Caesar crossed the Rubicon to seize power.
That's the perfect analogy. Science can give you the arm movement. But only humanistic understanding, only history, can give you the ambition, the meaning. If you reduce history to physics, you lose what makes it human.
Now, we have to talk about the critics, because not everyone is on board with the Williams method. There's an essay by John Marenbaum with the incredibly blunt title, Why Bernard Williams is a Bad Example for Historians of Philosophy.
It's a provocation, for sure. And Marenbaum is a very serious historian of philosophy, so his critique carries a lot of weight.
And his argument is what, in a nutshell?
He argues that Williams is just too selective. He basically accuses him of cherry picking.
Cherry picking the weird stuff, the stuff that creates that alienation effect he likes so much.
Exactly. Marenbaum says Williams only focuses on the ideas that are philosophically stimulating to him right now, or that create a dramatic contrast with our own views. But in doing that, he ignores the actual history of influence.
How ideas actually traveled through time, how they mutated.
Right. He misses the messy, continuous, often boring story of transmission. He just jumps from one high peak to another, creating what Marenbaum calls a gappy history. If you're a historian who wants to map the whole river, Williams is just hopping across a few photogenic stones.
Okay, that's a strong critique.
Okay.
And then there's Ralph Wedgwood's essay, The Iniquity of Oblivion. Which, by the way, sounds like an amazing title for a metal album.
It really does. It's very dramatic. But Wedgwood is arguing for a different value of history altogether. Not genealogy, but salvage.
Salvage. As in rescuing ideas from being forgotten.
Precisely. His main example is Stoic logic. For centuries, it was almost completely forgotten. Everyone thought Aristotle's logic was the only game in town.
Right.
But Stoic logic was rediscovered, and it turns out it's a form of propositional logic, incredibly similar to the logic that Gottlob Frege developed at the foundations of modern analytic philosophy.
So an entire way of thinking was just lost, and we had to reinvent it.
Exactly. And Wedgwood's point is, if we only do Williams's genealogy of us, if we only trace the historical path that led directly to our current concepts, we miss all the roads not taken. We miss the tools we dropped along the way.
That makes a lot of sense. We need history to expand the menu of options, not just to tell us the recipe for the one meal we're already eating.
That's a great way to put it. We need a larger inventory of theoretical options. Who knows, the solution to a 21st century problem might be sitting in a forgotten text from the 3rd century.
So we have the method, the case studies, the critiques. Let's try to pull this all together. Miranda Fricker has an essay that really synthesizes this idea of impure philosophy.
Fricker's piece is brilliant here. She completely embraces that label. She says Williams championed impure philosophy because he was reacting against what he saw as a sterile, abstract, a historical form of philosophy that was becoming dominant. He thought philosophy must mix with history, with sociology, with politics. It has to live in the real world.
And she describes his method as having a two-tier structure. What is that?
It's his way of handling historical interpretation. Tier one is the basic facts, the chronicle, the text, what actually happened. You can't just make things up. If Plato didn't write it, you can't say he did.
That's the bedrock.
That's the bedrock. But tier two is the interpretive activity. And that is where you make sense of those facts for us.
So there isn't one single true interpretation of the past on tier two.
There's no single interpretive truth. Fricker says there is only truthful sense making. You have to be accurate and responsible to the facts on tier one, but the meaning you pull from them for tier two will always be shaped by who you are and what questions you're asking of the past.
So every generation gets to rewrite the history of philosophy for itself.
Not just gets to, but has to. It's a necessary process.
And Geraldine Ng adds one more layer to this, connecting it all back to Williams's famous theory of internal reasons. This is a bit technical, but I think it's important for the students listening.
It is. So Williams's internal reasons theory, put simply, says that for you to have a reason to do something, that reason has to connect to your existing motivations, your desires, your projects, what he calls your subjective motivational set.
You can't just tell someone you have a reason to do X because a universal law says so. It has to hook into who they already are.
Exactly. And Eng's point is brilliant. To know who someone is, to know their motivational set.
You have to know their history.
You have to know their history, their biography, their context, their culture, their dispositions. You can't explain why an agent has the reasons they do without telling a historical story about them. So even in his most analytic, ethical work, Williams is relying on a deeply historical way of thinking.
Wow. So it's all connected. What does all of this mean for us then? For the listener who is maybe a student trying to write a paper or just someone who loves thinking about these big questions.
It means that if you try to think about your values, about liberty, about truth, about what it means to be a good person, without looking at where those ideas came from, you're flying blind. You're treating what might be temporary local habits as if they were eternal cosmic laws.
Philosophy without history is self-defeating.
It is. It's like trying to understand a building by only ever looking at the top floor. You have no idea what the foundations are made of. And sometimes when you finally go down and check the foundations, you realize they're crumbling or that they were built for a totally different purpose than you thought.
And here's the final provocation for me. If our most cherished values our belief in authenticity, our commitment to individual liberty, if these are historical accidents, does that make them less valuable? That's the fear, isn't it? If we see the history, the magic just disappears.
That is the ultimate question Williams leaves us with, and he doesn't think so. He thinks realizing that our values are contingent doesn't mean we have to abandon them. What it means is that we have to take responsibility for them.
They aren't commanded by God or the universe.
No. We have to actively maintain them. We have to choose them. They're our project.
That makes the responsibility so much heavier.
Much heavier. And, he would argue, much more meaningful.
So, to our listeners, especially the students out there, I think the call to action from this book is don't just read it for the excellent essays on Plato or Hume. Read it to learn how to think historically about your own philosophical problems. Use this book as the toolkit it's meant to be.
Go find the untimely voices. Let them alienate you. It's the only way to really understand where you're standing right now.
Couldn't have said it better. Thanks for diving deep with us on this one.
My pleasure.
We'll see you next time.